Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. And just a warning here at the top of this segment, for the remainder of the hour, we're going to be talking about some sensitive topics that may not be appropriate for all listeners, especially children. So we'll just take a pause for a second here if you need it. All right, allegations that Michael Jackson sexually abused children have been in and out of the headlines for years, and now they're resurfacing in a big way because of the HBO documentary Leaving Neverland. Part one aired last night, the second part runs tonight. And the film features two men who describe in graphic detail being groomed and molested by Jackson when they were boys. Beyond the claims themselves, Leaving Neverland is fueling a fierce debate about Jackson's musical legacy and what we should do with any collection of art after its creator is accused of monstrous crimes. Joining us now to discuss is Boston Globe columnist Renee Graham. She wrote a personal reflection before the release of Leaving Neverland called R. Kelly is Canceled. Is it time to cancel Michael Jackson? Renee, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Joe Bennett, musicologist and vice president of academic affairs at Berklee College of Music. Joe, thanks for being with us.
Hi, good to be here.
And listeners, we want to hear from you as well. Has your relationship with Michael Jackson's music changed since these allegations resurfaced? Is it possible to separate artists from their art? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, just to start, for those who have not seen the first part of Leaving Neverland, the documentary profiles two men, Wade Robson and James Safechuck, who say they were sexually abused by Jackson as boys. They both tell stories of being singled out by the star for their acting or dancing talent and then being groomed by him on lavish vacations, in his homes in Los Angeles, and on the Neverland Ranch. Let's listen to Wade Robson right at the beginning of the film.
He was one of the kindest, most gentle, loving, caring people I knew. He helped me tremendously. He helped me with my career. He helped me with my creativity, with all of those sorts of things. And he also sexually abused me.
And I'll point out that Jackson's family denies these allegations and his estate is suing HBO. In 2005, Jackson was acquitted on charges related to the alleged sexual abuse of a different 13-year-old boy. Robson actually testified in Jackson's defense at that trial, but now says he lied to protect the singer. All right, Renee, I want to come to you. You know, you wrote that after the Me Too movement broke open and revelations against many powerful men came to light, you threw out a lot of the stuff you used to love. So, you know, movies that starred Kevin Spacey, or maybe they were produced by Harvey Weinstein. You tossed out classic hip hop from Russell Simmons' Def Jam Records and, of course, R. Kelly's music. So why was Michael Jackson different? I mean, why did you hang on to his vinyls and memorabilia?
No, my memories of Michael Jackson just went so deep. And, you know, it was never an issue where I didn't believe his accusers. I just put the accusations aside and continued to be a Michael Jackson fan. And so when I was sort of looking at all of these things in my music and movie collections, it never even occurred to me to remove Michael Jackson's music.
So what changed your mind then? Because you said in the close of your latest piece that you did ultimately decide that you need to move on from Michael Jackson. So if it wasn't believing the accusers for the first time, what shifted?
You know, I think what really shifted was all the attention on R. Kelly, and I was writing a lot about the accusations against R. Kelly, and I would get upset when people would defend R. Kelly or would just continue to play his music. And I was at a friend's birthday party last year, and, you know, one of his songs came on, and everybody went to the dance floor, and I was literally stomping around on the sideline going, are we really still listening to R. Kelly? How is this possible? You've heard the accusations. Why would you still be listening to his music? And I just knew that if they had played, you know, Michael Jackson's Working Day and Night or Remember the Time, I would have been the first person on that dance floor. And I had to ask myself, why was that different? And I think it just hit a point where the hypocrisy was more than I could abide.
So, Joe Bennett, I want to come to you as a musicologist here, because I think what Renee is describing is pretty common. She's talking about the sort of ability to compartmentalize the person and the art and sort of keep them separate. And so you used to say, anyway, that you could analyze a piece of music, you know, purely on its structure, the melodies, the components, and leave aside the considerations of the artist's life. Do you still think that way?
Well, it's a point of view that I've really had to reevaluate because, you know, with training as a musicologist, you're encouraged to look at the nuts and bolts of the piece of music, to pull it apart, look at the chords and the lyrics and the melody and the arrangement, instrumentation and so on. And those things are kind of independent decisions, I always used to believe, of somebody's character. And yet some of these... This has happened now so many times in my own lifetime of an artist whose music or art or movies or whatever that I admired having just horrendous allegations against them and in many cases convictions. I have to say it's just happened one too many times for me now. I really feel that it is very difficult to pull those things apart, especially perhaps in popular music where the individual is the central performer. And so by buying into a Michael Jackson vocal, you're buying into kind of everything that he is, his character, the persona that he puts across.
Right, listeners, if you'd like to chime into this conversation, whether your views of Michael Jackson and his music have changed or not, do you still thrill to Thriller or are you thinking about his music in an entirely different way? You can give us a ring at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'd like to play one more clip from the documentary here. This is a piece of archival tape. It's of James Safechuck, and he's doing this sort of mock interview with Michael Jackson on the plane ride back from Hawaii. This is Safechuck as a boy, and he's talking about the vacation that he was just on with his mom and Michael Jackson, and Jackson says that Safechuck made him feel really special. Jackson seldom gave interviews, and it's this really sort of stark window into how he interacts with children at the time. So let's take a listen. You'll hear Safechuck's voice first.
How did you like Hawaii? What was your like best thing?
My best thing about Hawaii? Being with you.
How do you feel about performing and stuff? Do you like it?
I love performing. It is the greatest thing in the world because I feel at home on stage. I could live on stage. I'm the most happiest when I'm on stage and when I'm with Jimmy and Safechuck.
So, Renee, I mean, that's new tape to our ears as we're watching that. But there was a lot of sort of contemporary evidence as we were watching Michael Jackson's career unfold about his at least odd relationship with children at the time. I'm curious, when you watch the documentary now, does it just cause you to reevaluate things that you had known and heard about before? How are you processing things right now as a former fan?
You know, I certainly... you know, watched the first 2 hours of the documentary and felt queasy the entire time because you see Michael Jackson with this procession of young boys and you think about, you know, 25 years ago when he was with Emmanuel Lewis or he was with this kid or he was with Corey Feldman or he was with Macaulay Culkin. You know, part of the horror in a way is that this isn't surprising. You know, people could make the argument that they didn't know about what Bill Cosby was eventually accused of. But not only do people know and suspect something was up with Michael Jackson and these young boys, but it became a kind of punchline. People made fun of it. It was a joke, you know, except it really wasn't that funny. And I think people made it into a joke because it made it easier to just listen to the music. Now, of course, with all of this, you go back and listen to some of those lyrics and you feel really uncomfortable when he's singing something like The Way You Make Me Feel. And he says, ain't nobody's business but mine and my baby. You know, and then you watch this documentary and you hear him, you know, telling these kids to keep it quiet and people can't find out about this because we'll both go to jail. You know, that's why I can't listen to the music anymore because I hear it very differently now.
I see you're breaking down those lyrics and it takes on new meaning. Let's go to the phones a little bit. Nicholas is calling in from Linden, New Hampshire. Nicholas, are you wrestling with Michael Jackson's music now?
I mean, I still listen to it. I mean, I don't regularly listen to it. I grew up listening to it and... I don't think I would stop listening to it now necessarily just because when I think of like Michael Jackson growing up and like the childhood that he went through, and just being a star so early, he never really had his own life and that doesn't excuse anything, but you know, he's a very damaged person from start to finish and he caused a lot of damage. And I think that kind of gives a different twist on his art where, you know, when you listen to it, you could also hear his own pain in it. And you know, you think about the pain that he caused. And I just think that there's a much bigger picture to Michael Jackson's music because of his own upbringing than there is maybe to something like R. Kelly or Bill Cosby.
Nicholas, thanks for the call. So a certain amount of sympathy there for the childhood that Michael Jackson had. Let's take one more. Richard is calling from Mashpee. Richard, how are you thinking about Michael Jackson's music these days?
It's interesting. And I don't know if it's because I am a musician or just a fan of music, but I truly separate the offstage persona with the artistic endeavors, the product that he put out. I mean, you listen to Off the Wall, which seemed to precede, it seems like Thriller On is the, I don't know, the tainted era, if you will, of his persona. But, you know, I think if you're a fan of music, you purely look into that and go, this is genius, and there's nothing better.
Richard.
So I separate the two.
Got it. Richard, thank you for the ring there. So, Joe, how about that argument? I mean, I'm curious, especially from your background, being in a school of music at Berklee. I mean, he's the king of pop, right? I mean, you know, do these accusations about Jackson's personal life affect, for example, how music instructors at a college like Berklee might use Michael Jackson as a teaching example? Can you still learn from him? Should you still learn from him?
Well, should you is the key question here. It's absolutely true that at Berklee, I think even this year, we've been doing some Michael Jackson tribute work and some of those ensembles. He's a hugely influential artist on pop history, and he's been involved in the creation of a huge amount of very influential popular music, I would say.
But just this year, yeah. I mean, are these conversations your students are having right now?
Well, absolutely. It's something that that we're all aware of, and this week particularly with the power of this documentary. But there are the question I feel we all need to wrestle with is, where is the threshold, both in terms of music, in terms of the level of the accusation or the event or the unpleasantness that's being described, and in terms of time. You know, for example, a bunch of Berklee students quite understandably paid tribute to Chuck Berry when he died recently and played some of his intros. Well, Chuck Berry has done prison time for sex offences, and yet that was a long time ago. Is it about the music, or is it about the history? Is it about the context of the time that that particular artist is acceptable to eulogise? And now with Jackson and these particular accusations surfacing, we're finding it so much more difficult. So I think it is very difficult for people, especially when the body of work is just so globally influential.
But what you're getting at, though, is sort of the broader question of how far do you go? I mean, you use Chuck Berry as an example. I'm reminded that Elvis Presley, for example, met his wife Priscilla when she was just 14, dated her as a teenager before marrying her. I mean, should we re-examine Elvis's history? You know what I mean? Like, how far do you go as a musicologist here?
Yeah, and the question was easy when I was just looking at notes and chords and so on. But as I say, this has happened now just too many times. And, you know, I've no way of knowing whether these particular accusations are true. They certainly seem credible, and those two young men seem very compelling in interview. But it is about a threshold. And I've been noting while looking at this just how vehement the Michael Jackson fan base is in the YouTube commentary. You know, they're not even really prepared to consider in some cases that there might be some substance to these allegations.
All right, listeners, again, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Jennifer is calling us from Belmont. Jennifer, how are you thinking about this issue right now?
Well, I'm thinking of it from a more classical music perspective, but I think it's relevant. My father was a conductor who emigrated here in the 30s because of Hitler, and he had been trained in the Wagnerian German tradition and was mostly an opera conductor, and Wagner was his specialty. Now, Wagner was a rabid anti-Semite. Dostoevsky was a rabid anti-Semite. There are all kinds of great musicians, artists, authors who are terrible people or who have terrible ideas. Does that mean you never listen to their music? Do you never read their books? Do you never look at their art? So I've grown up separating out the value of the creation from the creator. because otherwise you never listen to great things or read great books. Terrible people have created wonderful things. Does that mean you blacklist them forever from the eyes and ears of the public? So that's where I'm thinking of it. I wonder how your guests relate to that.
Yeah, it's a good question, Jennifer, and thank you for the call and for sharing your thoughts. So, Renee Graham, how about that argument from our caller, Jennifer, there? I mean, does she have you reconsidering your reconsideration of Michael Jackson? I mean, she's saying you can separate the two.
I'm not going to reconsider it. I mean, look, you know, I look at Michael and I think also, again, as I mentioned, Bill Cosby. Can you watch The Cosby Show and still feel the same way about it? Here was a classic, important sitcom. Okay, considered one of the great sitcoms of all time, but you're going to have Bill Cosby as this family man, which is exactly the way he portrayed himself in real life. And of course, now he's in jail because we know that there were all these accusations that turned out to be true. I don't see how you separate those two things. You know, it's individual. I'm not going to say that Michael Jackson's music needs to be banned everywhere. I'm just saying it's banned from my life.
You know, sometimes when these accusations become public, we say that they've been hiding in plain sight all along for years. I'm thinking of that famous Seth MacFarlane joke at the Oscars 6 years ago about women having to flirt with Harvey Weinstein. The R. Kelly accusations that Renee mentioned earlier, those were out there for years. And this is Michael Jackson, in his own words, speaking with journalist Martin Bashir in a 2003 documentary that aired on ABC.
But I have slept in the bed with many children. I sleep in the bed with all of them. When Macaulay Culkin were little, Kieran Culkin would sleep on this side. Macaulay Culkin's on this side. His sister's in there. We're all just jamming the bed. And we wake up like dawn and go in a hot air balloon. You know, we have the footage. I have all that footage.
But is that right, Michael?
It's very right.
So, Renee, I mean, there's Michael Jackson, just one example on tape, admitting a long time ago that he would share his bed routinely with children. So can you speak to how fans have rationalized this in a way that allowed them to continue enjoying his music and for some continues to allow them to enjoy his music?
Well, you know, when he was doing those interviews and talking about sleeping in bed with these children, a lot of people initially went, well, that's not right. You know, why would Michael Jackson be sleeping in a child who's not his own child? And what's that about? People didn't approve of it. It never stopped them from listening to the music. They just made those separations between the art and the artist. And the thing Michael Jackson did do was in talking about it, nobody else had to expose that he was doing this. He talked about it, which in a funny kind of way, I think, normalized it for a lot of people. Well, if there was something wrong with it, he wouldn't be talking about it on TV, would he? You know, the same way that when the accusations first came out, he was immediately on television talking about being interrogated by the police and being, you know, strip searched by the police. He talked about that. So not only did he engender sympathy, but he was very open about what was going on, which I think allowed some people to believe that there couldn't be something far more nefarious here.
You hear in there perhaps a possible parallel to Larry Nassar, the gymnast who was convicted of sexual abuse of gymnasts, who had this cover story. He was very open about what he was doing. He just sort of said it was for medical reasons. You know, here you have Michael Jackson saying.
And in some cases, he did it in front of the gymnast's parents.
Right.
They were in the room when this was going on.
And of course,
Michael Jackson saw the same thing.
Right, right. Parents were often on board with having their children stay over at the Neverland Ranch. I did mention earlier that Jackson's family denies that his relationships with children were ever sexual. And Gail King interviewed Michael Jackson's brothers, Jackie, Marlon, and Tito, and his nephew, Taj, on CBS This Morning last Wednesday. I want to play a little bit of that interview. This is Tito, the oldest, answering a question about, you know, don't you think you should at least watch the documentary to evaluate the claims? And he says, no, I don't need to.
I don't have to see that documentary. I know Michael. I'm the oldest brother. I know my brother. I know what he stood for, what he was all about, bringing the world together, making kids happy.
And he was never, in your opinion, abusive to children?
No, never.
Never, never inappropriate with children?
Never
in a sexual way?
No, in a sexual way. And the people that really know him, they know the truth, too.
So there's that familiar argument that, yes, he had relationships with children, but it never crossed the line into something inappropriate. I want to go back to the calls right now. Chris is calling from Somerville. Chris, how are you thinking about this issue?
Hey, thanks for taking my time. Yeah, so I grew up in the early 90s and first learned about Michael Jackson through reading magazines like Time or Newsweek and hearing about these molestation charges. And when he passed, I was a little shocked about the memories going around, positive memories of Michael Jackson from the art people experience when they're teenagers listening to Thriller and whatnot. So I hope people try and remember that this guy is a pedophile and that there are alternative musical and dance icons such as Mr. Brown, who has performed things like the Moonwalk and other amazing musical feats for you to idolize instead of Michael Jackson.
Chris, thanks for the call. So, Joe Bennett, how about that argument? I mean, I think that Chris makes a good point there. I mean, Michael Jackson, for all of his creative genius, didn't appear in a vacuum. I mean, he was influenced by others who came before him as well. I mean, is perhaps a reexamination of Jackson's musical legacy a chance to credit some of his predecessors as well?
Well, indeed. And I've always argued in my academic work that all popular music is basically created through cultural Darwinism. One thing influences another and it gives birth to another. And Jackson was influenced by others and went on to influence many others. But it seems to me that this is something particular to pop music, that because of the persona of the pop singer, the songwriter, the authenticity that we perceive in them, you know, for example, we don't apply these same values to architecture or fine art. We don't see a painting and think, well, I learned something horrible about that painter's past, and therefore I'm not going to take an interest in their visual art. So it seems to be something particular to the emotional connection, the very direct, visceral emotional connection that we have with popular music, that we feel this sort of sense of betrayal when we learn something highly unpleasant about someone whose work we admire.
So, Renee, in the moments that we have left, if you've canceled R. Kelly, you've canceled Michael Jackson, what's left on your playlist? Who are you listening to these days? And perhaps thinking with trepidation,
you know,
what am I going to learn next?
My playlist is kind of a mess in a way because, you know, I have Marvin Gaye on my playlist and Rick James and James Brown, all of whom have, you know, have passed on, but still have really seedy moments in their histories in terms of dating underage girls, of violence against women. I mean, you know, you can go round and round on this an awful lot. You just have to sort of pick your moments and decide, you know, what's your moment of reckoning? And I think I've reached mine with Michael Jackson.
That's Boston Globe columnist Renee Graham. Renee, thanks for joining us today on Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Also with us was Joe Bennett, Vice President for Academic Affairs at Berklee College of Music. Joe, thank you for being here.
Thanks very much.
Part 2 of Leaving Neverland airs on HBO tonight, and both parts are available to stream at HBO.com. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, Eve Zukoff, and Walt Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.